So this guy, the refrigeration guy, suddenly runs around and starts buying every derelict vessel in town. He bought like 11 boats mm-hmm. in 2 days, right? And got them all on $3,500 a day contract. Yeah. And plus, they were on the contract while he was doing the engine repairs to get them running. They didn't get out there. Some of them never did make it out on the water, but he collected hundreds of thousands of dollars for them. And this exact question was put to him by the local newspaper editor during those same few days. As soon as it got out, it was, you know, it's a small town. Everybody knew exactly what was going on right away. And he wasn't trying to hide it. He said, yeah, I'm a bull pal with what's his name over there. He says, get all the boats he can, you know. So, and his famous quote in the Cordova Times was, I may not be the smartest guy on the dock, but I can add. And believe me, nobody wanted to be in line behind that guy. Yeah. So it was like, oh no, from bad to worse, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know? So I guess.
So people were scrambling, but the lesson that was learned by the commercial fishing fleet was don't be late.
Yeah.
And that's why we have such good participation in the current response plan by commercial fishing boats. People want to get their training, they want to go to these 3-day drills once mm-hmm. a year. And practice with the equipment, the boom and the skimmers and stuff, because they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to be the last guy to get called. They want to be the first guy next time. There's a real commercial, you know, commercial fishermen are commercial guys. It's all about the money, you know. And believe me, that this is just this is another fishery for us. What I've spent the last 12 years telling the oil industry, the federal government, and the state government is that of all the people on this planet, there is only one group that thinks recovering oil off the sea is an easy task, not a hard task. And that group are commercial fishermen. We don't see it as mission impossible to go out there and collect a major oil spill and bring it back to town. That's what we do for a living. We are professionals at going out, leaving port, going out into the wilds of the coastal sea, collecting vast amounts of organic material and bringing it back to town. That's our specialty. We're designed to do it. We're multi-generation people born to this trade. Believe me, this is easy. Let's take a look at the facts. Oil isn't even afraid of you. It's not trying to run away. It has no survival instinct out there. You know, it has no friends. The federal government and the state government are not trying to make sure that some of them survive for the next generation, you know, that we're not limited in the equipment we can use. We can, anything we can devise is just fine, you know, as big a nets as we want, you know, we can do it. I mean, this is child's play, you know. There's nobody looking over your shoulder saying, oh, you can't do that, you can't do this, you can't do that. You know, and you can see it from the surface of the water. Herring, one of our big fisheries, you can't see. You have no idea where it is. You have to have an airplane in communication with you over the top of your boat to tell you where the fish are, because they're invisible from the flying bridge of the boat. You can't see them. So you have to be set. Your net has to be set by an airplane. You know, and that's the story I always tell. I was in on the single biggest bite in human history. It was 1992, Togiak herring season. You know, there were 250 seine boats, mine being one of them, up there in Togiak. It's very isolated northern side of Bristol Bay. And there was a tremendous herring resource, and it was very well managed by the Alaska Fish and Game Department, who were taking lots of consultations with the highline herring fishermen and stuff and deciding exactly when we wanted to take this herring mass. And we harvested 250,000 tons of herring in 20 minutes when they opened the season. Everybody got to set, 250 seine boats got to set their nets exactly once on this resource. And within 8 hours, we had them all pumped aboard a fleet of 100 tenders under food grade conditions. And 24 hours later, there was not a boat in Togiak Bay. 250,000 tons of herring is exactly the same amount that Exxon Valdez spilled. And we picked it up in Togiak in 20 minutes. You have no idea how good commercial fishermen are at this shit. You know, and I've told that story 100 times to various power players, and they've listened over the years, and we have a major part of the response plan in Prince William Sound now. And it should be the same down here. I spent the last 2 years talking to extensively to the state of Washington on doing the same thing in Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. But they haven't had their spill yet, so they're not interested in making any waves down here. It's one of those things you can't get inoculated against. You have to suffer the full-blown disease before you get an immune system to it. Mm-hmm. It's a pity because they have a great commercial fishing fleet down here. It could make mincemeat out of a spill in Puget Sound, but it won't because they refuse to train it, you know. And so they let one of the other stories I tell is the current state of, in 1989 in particular, the state of oil spill preparedness was analytical to, analogous to, let's say, Alaska Airlines crashed a jetliner into the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, and the word would then be, well, Alaska Airlines broke the bridge, they have to fix it, you know. That's where we're at. And that's where, to a large extent, that's where we're still at. You know, the federal government has more responsibilities to oversee it getting done now, but it's still a responsible party has to fix the mess. And, you know, would we do that? Would we just wait for Alaska Airlines to fix the Golden Gate Bridge? I think not. I think we'd hire the experts to do it. You know, well, the experts in oil spill response is not the oil industry. Sorry, they may be the responsible party, but they are not the professionals. The professionals are commercial fishermen. You know, it's so close to what we normally do. It's just a very easy quarry that only appears very seldom, thank God. But if with a little bit of training and preparation, we could knock the shit out of oil spills, major oil spills. Mm-hmm. And if they ever dare to spill anything major in Prince William Sound again, we will. The biggest spill they had, we cleaned up very adroitly. Where is that? Here. This part. This is 2001. This is the biggest spill in Prince William Sound since the oil spill. It was a 25,000-gallon diesel spill from a sunk fish processor. Mm-hmm. And we cleaned it up entirely within 3 days. Diesel is notoriously difficult to clean up. It evaporates so rapidly, thank God, that it's vaporizing to the extent that 30 to 50% is all of it. There were no beach impacts from this spill. You know, the state gave us 30 to 50% credit on picking it up. This is great. Look at the skipper.
She's from Homer, I know her.
Yeah. That's a great interview. And she's bored, man. It's too easy.
Yeah. But she's like 25 in this picture or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And they did a superb job. And it was the only actual time the fishing vessel plan has been activated this way and sound on a real spill. And it worked superbly. Everyone gave us kudos for making it look like child's play, which is what it is for commercial fishermen.
Right.
In both in 89 and 90, I was back in D.C. for several weeks helping push the legislation through the Congress. It was very gratifying. I went back in 89 on my own, pretty much. There wasn't much organization amongst any of the fishermen who were back there in 89, but I was completely independent of what organization there was. And I had one issue, which was they had proposed a number of special requirements for Prince William Sound in terms of preparedness, so double escorts on all the tankers and all this kind of stuff, and a number of very specific response requirements that were going to be much higher than anywhere else in the country. We had managed to get a lot of good stuff in OP-90, particular to Prince William Sound. We were not going to have another spill. One of the goals of OP-90 was once is enough for Prince William Sound. Boys, you screwed it up, so you really have to be careful from now on in there and spend the money to get ready, and all, et cetera, right? And it was a good piece of legislation. But they had drawn the map of Prince William Sound, leaving out the major hazard. Seal Rocks and Hinchinbrook Entrance is clearly, from any mariner's point of view, the number one hazard on the tanker route. You know, that's where we're going to have, you know, it took a drunk and a number of instant, you know, number of problems, the Coast Guard not watching the radar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to have a wreck on Bligh Reef. That's what the Coast Guard Commandant said when he first showed up. He said, how could you do that? My daughter could drive a tanker past that and not hit it. You know, I mean, you know, he was just aghast that that was where it happened and where everyone assumed it was going to happen and still assume it's going to happen is Seal Rocks. A very nasty place right in the middle of Hinchinbrook entrance. But they had drawn the line for the special requirements in federal legislation between Hinchinbrook and Zykov Point, which Seal Rocks is like 500 yards outside it. So he was being left entirely out of the extensive planning for oil response, mm-hmm. you know, just by this, you know, whoever drew the map had gotten it wrong, and of course everyone, no one would change it, you know, so I had to go back to, I went back there with my charts and everything, and managed to get the line redrawn. In committee, you know, I just said, hey, I am a mariner there. I, you know, ask around, boys, you're about to screw this up big time. And I expected I was going to have to come up with documentation and a million arguments and all this stuff. And it took me about 5 minutes with the right guy. He said, oh, yeah. There's a rock there? Holy shit. You know, okay, we'll do this. Dunk, dunk, you know. Done deed, you know. And that whets your appetite when you actually manage to personally change federal law.
Yeah.
You know, it's a plane ticket was worth it.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, that's heavy stuff.
And so I was hooked on public involvement at that point in this oil thing, and I managed to have a very successful career, if I say so myself, as a citizen activist in safe oil transportation in Prince William Sound. And it's been very gratifying to be a part of RCAC, which has been it's a learning. I mean, you know, we had a lot of ups and downs, and I got thrown out of RCAC one time over a very contentious issue, but I got myself back in, you know, we've, you know, it's a family, man. It's brutal, you know, and one of the more brutal things was moving to Valdez. Yeah. You know, that damn near as close as anything else to dissolving the minimum amount of cooperation necessary to have an 18-person membership from 10 different towns, all of whom are antagonistic to each other, of course, mm-hmm. and especially antagonistic to Valdez, right?
Yeah.
But eventually we came to our reluctant decision that, yeah, we had to move to Valdez and tough it out in the oil town, and it's worked. Hmm. We still have an office in Valdez, I mean in Anchorage, because but it's only about a third of the employees are in Anchorage now, and at least two-thirds are in Valdez.
Huh. I haven't seen the Valdez office, but I'm familiar with the Anchorage office.
And we have wonderful people. The great thing about RCAC is that one of the great strengths of RCAC is we have long-term employees. You know, both the state, federal government, and Exxon, and the industry, Alyeska, rotate people through so rapidly. You know, they do a two-year tour duty and they're gone. Well, who brings them up to speed when they show up?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, of course, the various agencies are trying to do that, but we have people who have been around for 10, 12, 15 years now.
Yeah.
They know this stuff backwards and forwards, and they can take a person aside early on in his stint and say, hey, you want to stay out of trouble?
Yeah.
Do some good? You know, here's the long-term analysis of this problem and where we're trying to point, the direction we're trying to point it in. Do what you can do to help us along. And it's been very successful. You know, people turn to us for advice, you know, because we've physically been there so long. Mm-hmm. You know, we are the local experts.
Yeah.
In all this stuff.
Yeah.
What all fishermen think happened. It was brought up before the National Transportation Safety Board study, but we had no proof and we couldn't get anybody to talk. So it's not any. It was investigated, but the wreck took place. The most famous thing about where the Exxon Valdez went aground is it was smack dab in the middle of the old steamer channel. The story. Have you heard this at all?
No.
The old steamer channel was a shortcut up to Valdez. From the rest of Prince William Sound, the mail boat always took it back, historically. The Siren would run the old steamer channel and stuff, and the navigation lights were set up to facilitate running the old steamer channel. It's between Bly Reef and Bly Island.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same. It's 600 feet wide and it's 60 feet deep, And it's it saves considerable amount of time not going out and around Bly Reef, but it also, more importantly, Bly Reef functions as a stopper for the largest icebergs that come off Columbia Glacier. So it's an ice-free, relatively speaking, as the biggest stuff isn't going to get in there. And the ice tends to stay in packs, and if the biggest stuff won't move over there, the little stuff doesn't go over either. So it's very ice-free compared to the main channel. And for that reason, especially the mailboat and other small boats that couldn't deal with the ice at all would use that channel. And there have been several reports at the time of the oil spill when fishermen were saying, oh yeah, I've seen the tankers take that course, and blah, blah, blah. And my sister was one of the people who had seen a tanker take that course. And damn near ran her over one day taking a shortcut. But it's not authorized. You know, it's outside the tanker lane. Tanker lanes go out around Bly Reef and up the middle of Valdez Arm. But that night, when Hazelwood left the tanker lanes to avoid the ice, we can surmise his last words to Cousins, which were, now we drove that old steamer channel last week. You think you can do it on your own? And Cousins said, yeah, no problem, man. Just line up those two lights. The two lights north, two navigation lights on the east side of Valdez Arm. The two lights are about 5 miles apart and on the headlands going in. You line those two lights up and make one out of them, and you're right down the center of the old steamer channel. And that's what they were doing that night. That's the only explanation for them going 11 knots. When they hit Bly Reef, they were going 11 knots and accelerating. Well, you don't go through ice at 11 knots. You go through ice at 3 knots in a tanker. They have never been able to explain their speed that night. And that's in the transportation study. You know, there's no explanation for the speed at which they were traveling. They were late, they were behind schedule, and there was heavy pack ice throughout the Narrows. If they were going to skirt the edge of the ice pack on the outside of Bly Reef, which is what the official story is that they were doing, they would have been going 3 knots. Not 11 knots. The only reason they could go 11 knots is their sure knowledge that there was an ice-free channel down the side of Bly Island, between Bly Island and Bly Reef. The problem was the visibility was too good. It was a bright, clear night. And on a smaller scale, I and most other commercial fishermen have done this repeatedly, in that you cannot hug the shadowy side of the channel close enough. It's just physically impossible to do it. At night, you can't drive your boat into that shadow as far as you should. And so you invariably scrape the outside of your boat on the inside of the outside of the channel. Yeah. Now you're trying to stay too far from that shadow. Time and time again, it happens to everybody. And it happened to Cousins that night. He was trying to run the old steamer channel, but he was too far away from Bly Island. And he scraped the outside. The right side of the Valdez, Exxon Valdez, hit the left side of Bly Reef, which is exactly what happened. You know, it's so classic. It's like, oh, one of those, you know.
So what
that's
been,
what happened.
What would have been so difficult about reporting that?
They would have been grossly negligent to have attempted that. And that would put them in a whole different category of liability. They would be criminally negligent. They were not criminally negligent. Exxon was not in the final judgment. Now, there was a big argument that they should be made criminally negligent for knowledgeably employing an alcoholic as a skipper of one of their vessels. But they had put him through rehab, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And they managed barely to squeak out of that charge, you know. And we couldn't prove it. We had to get Cousins or the gal on the bow, or there were three or four people that knew what they were doing that night, but none of them would talk. Mm-hmm. But that's what actually happened. See, and that's why we spent so much energy in 1989 and 1990 getting the double escorts. Mm-hmm. The main reason for the double escorts is not their ability to rescue a tanker in trouble. It is to make sure that everything stays on the up and up. We now have three skippers, supposedly relatively independent of each other, whose career is on the line for anything like these shortcuts. Yeah. You know, and that's exactly what the fishermen wanted those escorts for, was to keep people from cheating.
Okay, now, before I forget these two questions that are buzzing in my head right now. So the buzz around Homer so much was, you know, that, yeah, Hazelwood had to go down, but that Cousins was, in fact, he was more at fault. But this is, in this scenario that you've described, it sounds almost as though Cousins was merely taking orders. I mean, it wasn't his call.
It's not his call. He's the first mate.
Right.
Or the third mate.
So he was doing what he was told to do.
Yeah.
By whom?
Hazelwood.
By Hazelwood. Hazelwood told him to do that. You know, take this. We just did it. Okay, so that... So we're,
it's one of the many things professionals do because they can get away with it. You know, that's why professionals exist, to bend the rules a little bit based on their judgment, right? Mm-hmm. And they were late.
Mm-hmm.
They were very late. They were behind schedule. And they were going to have to creep out of the Valdez arm at 3 knots,
mm-hmm.
you know, through this pack ice. It was going to beat them up and scratch the paint and all this kind of stuff. They'd have been a lot more sensible. And these days, they wouldn't have been allowed to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, one of the many things we have is, you know, that you have to have any time there any kind of ice out in the sound, you have to have an ice escort, and you have to do it in the daylight, you know. So you can see what you're doing. But none of those rules were there that night. So he was being pressured corporate. He was feeling definite corporate pressure to make up lost time. He was behind schedule. And they had done. We can't prove that they've done it before, but you can damn well bet they'd run that shortcut before. And that's what he asked Cousins. He says, remember then when we ran up the old steamer channel? You just got to keep those two lights together off the stern and you go right through. No problem, right? And Cousins said, yes, sir. No problem, sir. But he, you know, if it had been a dark, stormy night, he'd have done it fine.
Yeah.
Because there wouldn't have been any visibility. But he was looking over at that cliff on the outside of Bly Island, and he couldn't drive himself close enough. It's an optical illusion-y thing. You know, it's not, you don't have to go into the shadow to have this effect. That big black wall is over there, man, and it just keeps you. You don't want to point your boat at it. I know I ought to be over there closer, but I can't do it. Crunch, you know,
so
you hit the outside, you know, every time.
So how
it happened
does,
to me 10 times. It happened once.
How does that?
If they had bothered to look out the stern of the Exxon Valdez at night, the following night, they'd have seen those two navigation lights as one to the north.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that...
Pretty good coincidence, huh?
That explanation, how does that square with what you said earlier about the Coast Guards looking at the, not detecting it on the radar? It works in tandem with that.
It's complacency, the key word of RCAC. We talk complacency at every meeting. You know, that's our duty. Our duty is to guard against complacency. Yeah.
So
that's the bottom line.
The Coast Guard wasn't looking, and Hazelwood made the call, Cousins took orders, and the whole thing went to hell.
The proximate cause of the oil spill was Coast Guard's failure to monitor the radars that night. And then their disgusting story that they were under-equipped with radars. I mean, you know, that was that didn't fly. The Coast Guard came to Cordova about day 4 of the spill or something and gave this big speech about how if they just had more federal funding for better radars, it never would have happened and stuff, you know. And 50 fishermen started throwing things at the commanders. And our radars cost $2,000, you know, and they're not 150 feet in the air like they are at Potato Point, you know. I mean, you could read the name on the hull of the Exxon Valdez at 30 miles that night. You know, it was ridiculous what he was trying to say, and we threw him out of town, literally would not let him speak again after he said that. He had to leave, you know, because it was just such a bald-faced lie, and everybody in town knew it. Because we all owned radars. Every single one of us owned a radar. A lot of us owned 2 or 3 radars, thank you very much. It cost a fraction of what the Coast Guard had in those old radars. You know, it was no, you know... They were not inoperative, and they were certainly up to the task. But you do have to change the range knob as the thing gets further away from you, or it drives off the goddamn screen.
And you do have to put your cards down and look.
Put your cards down and look once in a while, right. And that's why we got RCAC, though. It was not because we couldn't trust, you know, Exxon. Everybody knew you couldn't trust Exxon. The message we carried in 89 and 90, back in, especially in 90, back to Congress was you can't trust the Coast Guard. You know, we don't trust the Coast Guard. Not a single person in Prince William Sound trusts the Coast Guard. They caused the oil spill, and they got off scot-free. Nobody got demoted. Right. Nobody got anything mentioned in their record. You know, they all retired right on schedule and went to work for the oil companies. You know, it's what they all do. You know, every Coast Guard commandant, I mean, every captain of the port we've had in Prince William Sound since long before the Exxon Valdez oil spill, up to the present day, every one of them got a job working for the oil industry immediately following their two years in Cordova. They immediately go to work at, they retire and go to work at several times their salary for the industry they're regulating. You know, it's the that's the deal. You make it to captain of the port, and then you retire and you start getting $200,000 a year from Exxon or British Petroleum or Alyeska or somebody. And those are the guys I'm dealing with. The guy, the head guy on the industry side of this renewal of the contingency plan that we're reviewing right now, is the ex-captain of the port, the first one after Exxon Valdez. You know, and he's now working for Exxon as their head contingency planner. You know.
Yeah.
You know, right. and that message was not lost on the Congress, and so they gave us what we wanted, which was $3 million a year. Actually, we get $2 million a year in open ID, and we got it up to over $3 million a year now negotiating with Alyeska because we perform a service for them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're cold-blooded enough to realize, much as they hate us, that they need us. You know, we haven't had another spill. You know, they get fairly decent publicity out of Alaska and stuff, you know. And if they had us on the North Slope, they wouldn't have had that spill up there last summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is there, this is, I have no idea how I'm going to be able to consolidate this story because.
Okay, so let me. Is how these things like the old steamer channel related to the double escorts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the kind of connections that I find interesting over the years. You know, we didn't get those double escorts because of their ability to like, as I say, save a tanker. For the first several years, they were mud boats, you know, brought up from Louisiana. They couldn't have done anything, you know, but except be there, right? That was the point. The whole idea was avoiding complacency, putting checks and balances into the system so people had to pay attention and had to do their job. We wanted a system that ran, you couldn't leave the dock with oil being transported through Prince William Sound if you didn't have two other skippers watching you for the entire route. That's where the double hull tankers, I mean the double escorts came from, not from some notion that they were going to be able to rescue the tanker. You know, eventually we've gotten to a point where we spend a lot of time worrying about their ability to actually perform a rescue under certain weather conditions and stuff. But that was not where it came from. Where it came from was the feeling, especially in the commercial fishing community, that we needed double and triple redundancy in making sure that people were doing their basic jobs and were not playing cards instead of watching the radar. And even the Coast Guard argued in D.C. that it was unnecessary to do this because they were on the job. It was their mission. You know, that was what they were being tasked with, was to make sure that these guys stayed in the tanker lanes and all that stuff. And you know, we just had to point out to the Coast Guard, point out to the Congress, that the National Transportation Safety Board said otherwise, that they were playing cards and couldn't switch the radar knob, couldn't bother to turn around and look, you know. And that's would be inevitably the situation a few years down the road. The problem with oil spills is they are so infrequent. It's like getting ready for the influenza bug. You know, you can't really take it serious. It hasn't happened in 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, we got all these immediate problems. We got potholes in the roads. We got kids with too many kids in the classrooms. We can't get ready for the stuff that's never going to happen as long as everybody does their job. You know, and that's exactly the way it is. Exactly the way it is in Washington State right now. You know, everyone focuses completely on prevention and there's no response system. And inevitably those prevention systems wither away because nothing has ever happened, you know. And so they understaff the radar people, and they do this, and they do that, and suddenly the system's running without any prevention either. And then you have the big disaster, exactly what happened at Prince William Sound. You know, the history of the pipeline is amazing in itself. We took them to the U.S. Supreme Court. CDFU did, my little fishing union, took, you know, the lack of a marine environmental impact statement to the U.S. Supreme Court. Stopped them cold from building the pipeline. It was going to take another 3 years to do the marine aspects that they should have done in the first place. And the problem was, it was the wrong route. They should have, the much safer route was down through Seward, the traditional oil importation point in Alaska. Resurrection Bay, a much shorter route to the open ocean. It's more expensive. They were going to save 300 miles of pipeline by going to Valdez instead of the Seward. That's why we went there. But it's much more dangerous maritime route. And we proved that up through the district and appellate courts all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, that they had to do a marine environmental impact statement. And so the engineer, coincidentally, we had the 72, this is 1972, and we had the first oil embargo, and the price went, you know, the gas lines and everything. And Congress passed an emergency bill with the deciding of Spiro T. Agnew. It was a 50-50 or 49-49 at that time, right? Tie in the Senate. And Spiro T. Agnew gave us the pipeline, cast the deciding vote. And to override, you know, to pass a special law saying no environmental impact statement would be needed in Prince William Sound for the national security. Got to build this thing, got to have it now, you know. And so we never did have a marine environmental impact statement, which led directly to the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Yeah.
You know, because we had no protections out there. We had no real contingency plan. And the state's always been much more interested in making money off oil than protecting its citizens from the aspects of it. Look at what happened to Susan Harvey up on the North Slope 2 years ago when she tried to, make them clean up their act up there, and she was promptly fired. You know, and she was the one that went public during the campaign on Tony Knowles, did in good old Tony Knowles, the worst governor Alaska's ever had. That guy couldn't sell out to the oil companies fast enough. Worst environmental record of any governor, much worse than Wally. I was wearing a campaign button that saying another Democrat for Wally during the re-election of that asshole, Tony Knowles. Couldn't sell out fast enough. Go check out the facts on North Star sometime. You know, we don't get a penny for that oil, and we're going to inevitably pollute the Arctic Ocean with that project. There will be a spill up there. We cannot clean it up. That's what got Susan Harvey fired, was her opposition to allowing them to do that North Star project, because they have not been able to show that they can respond to an oil spill up there. They cannot respond to an oil spill. They'll have one, and we won't even know about it for 6 months under the ice, you know. And we don't get a penny for it, not a penny. It's so hard to do, according to the Knowles administration, that we can't really put any, you know, tax on it. We just have to give it away for some reason. Tony, don't get me started. But that, you know, and I think Susan had a part of doing him in. I guess nobody wanted Tony again.
Yeah.
But and the gal kind of doesn't seem too bad right off the bat.
Oh yeah, Lisa Murkowski.
Well, no, the new governor. What's her name?
Oh, right, Sarah Palin.
Yeah, people like her better than they like Tony, or from the oil point of view.
They sure like her better than they like Fred or Frank.
Yeah. But Lisa seems pretty good.
Yeah, she's a lot more together than it appears.
She's like a hard-working gal.
Yeah, she...
But anyway, you really ought to... I think you ought to fit in the blockade into this. Now, your overseers may not agree, but... CAC may not agree, but I think one of the great untold stories was the 1993 blockade of Valdez Narrows by the commercial fishing fleet. Right from the start, we'd been telling the Coast Guard and the oil industry in particular that make no mistake about who runs Prince William Sound. It's the commercial fishing fleet that runs Prince William Sound. We're used to it. We can resupply ourselves. We can choke Valdez Narrows with boats anytime we choose. And we can resupply those boats, and it'll take you months to get us out of that waterway. And there we go, that'll never happen. So in 1993, we did it. You know, we put 100 boats across the Valdez Narrows. and shut them down. We shut the oil industry down for 3 days. You know, we would not allow an empty tanker to come into port. And it was very successful. We did it because we had Babbitt, the Secretary of Interior for Clinton, Bruce Babbitt from Arizona, ex-governor of Arizona, was the Interior Secretary, and he was touring North Slope, as a matter of fact, and during the middle of our non-season of 1993, so we all stormed our way up from our corners of Prince William Sound up into the Valdez Narrows and formed a blockade. It was wonderfully done. It was a marvelous 3 days, and a million stories came out of that. But and we sat down, Bill Black and I, were sitting on each side of Bruce Babbitt in Valdez, and he said, "What's this all about?" You know, we ran had a huge fight with the editor of the Valdez Vanguard, throwing him out of this, saying, you know, would not allow the press into this meeting with the fishermen, right? And he was screaming and yelling and going to call the cops and all this shit. But Babbitt said, "Get him out of here," you know, and he got him out. And Babbitt's first words were, "So I hear we're here to talk about an exit strategy." And Jim Gray was, "Yeah, that's what we're talking about. How do we get out of this mess?" You know, because you know, by that time they had, you know, it was right after Waco, you know, which is one of the reasons I think the Coast Guard is being so careful not to let it escalate. And we've been on the radio for days with them saying, "We're all Republicans out here. We're small businessmen. We are not communists. You know, we want a deal. We are ready to negotiate. You know, we don't like sitting out here in the middle of this federal waterway." You know, the first successful blocking of a federal waterway in over 100 years, the Coast Guard called it. They were very impressed. And we did. It was wonderful, wonderful 3 days.
Well, tell me more about it.
We all got up there, and
you're talking about Cordova fishermen.
Yeah, Cordova fishermen. This is the Cordova Seine fleet. Mm-hmm. Was fishing the Cape, and there were no fish. You know, absolutely no fish. And a number of my friends started talking about something that I had brought up. I was incapacitated. I had this scar here going up here like this. I had stabbed myself in the thumb, broke a tendon, and had to fly to Anchorage and chase the tendon up the arm deal, you know. I was in the hospital for a couple of days and had to drive to Valdez in a rental car to rejoin my boat, which my crew had run up there with the fleet, you know. But so I got to kind of roundabout. And so I can't take credit for the instigation of this blockade, although it had been one of my themes for years, you know, politically. And my friends finally listened to me, by God, and they did it the first time I was not around. And but there were two motives. The public motive was to get Exxon to pay. It's been 5 years since the spill, where's our money, you know? And that, frankly, was why 90 of the 100 boats went, was to force Exxon to the bargaining table. But the 10, the ringleaders, had a very different motive, and that was to the very odd fact that 5 years after the oil spill, the natural resource damage claim had been settled voluntarily between the federal and state governments and Exxon years before, right after the oil spill, $100 million for natural resource damage. And the trustees council had been set up, three state and three federal trustees spending this money to recover the environment. But they wouldn't spend a dime on either herring or salmon, the two big commercial species in Prince William Sound. And their lame line was that would be settled under the civil damages suit, which is a flat lie. You know, we were not suing for natural resource damage claims. That had been settled. The money to fix up the salmon and herring runs were part of that natural resource damage claim, of course. But we were just being lied to by the trustees of the council, saying it was going to come out of the civil damages, which could not be. It was ridiculous. Anyone who was halfway literate in the law would know that's not the case, you know. And so we couldn't figure it out. I mean, we had a big union meeting, and one of the guys stood up and said, "This smells like a deal the Exxon lawyers made when they voluntarily signed off on the $100 million, that we couldn't use the money that would in any way produce evidence to be used against them in the civil damages suit. If we could, if some of the research, some of that money had furthered research that showed actual damage to the herring and salmon stocks, then we could have sued for that damage. But so they wouldn't spend any money on the herring and salmon. We hadn't spent a dime on it. Millions for pedigree falcons and Muircasters and cormorants and anything else, you know, sea lions, sea otters, but not a dime for herring and salmon was coming out of that huge pool of money. And as soon as he said it, it just rang true. But we, none of us had known much about lawyers in 89, but by 93, we were much more savvy about the way lawyers work. And it just struck home that that's exactly what had happened. Exxon had protected itself against any of this money being used that would, in any way, shape, or form that would look bad for them in the civil damages suit. So we were getting no money spent on herring and salmon. And we, and I had been saying that we could fix this with the only chance with Babbitt, because Babbitt appointed all three federal members of the trustees. You know, NOAA had one, and anybody, they all worked for the Department of Interior. And he appointed all three of them. And so we just needed to get to him, and he was in the state. You know, about that time I had to go off to the hospital. But anyway, they got everybody organized on the Let's Get Exxon banner, and we all went storming up there through a horrible stormy night, and people risked their lives running up to Valdez Arm that night. And that's half why they were so tenacious when they got up there. They'd gone through a life-threatening situation with their families. Summer Saining in Alaska is a family operation. Half the boats had kids and wives on them and everything. But they'd blasted their way up through this fairly big summer storm and gotten up there. And blockaded, you know, had 100 boats lined up in a line. Great pictures of these boats lined up across the Valdez Narrows and stuff. And the Coast Guard just freaked out. They couldn't believe what was happening. It was like nuclear war for them or something, you know. Active civil disobedience, closing down a federal waterway. It's nothing bigger for the Coast Guard than maintaining open waterways. You know,
yeah.
And we had shut down the oil company. And we let the laden tankers could leave. We didn't want to cause any safety problems. You know, they could, anything was already in there could leave, full of oil, but nobody else could come in. We were shutting the port down to traffic, and we did it for 3 days. And I'd gotten back there and was preaching to everybody, "Don't worry about it." You know, the Coast Guard had come out. The Coast Guard was just frantic that nobody get hurt. Nobody gets hurt. And there was this huge, biggest snag, deadhead snag I'd ever seen in my whole fishing career. Was happened to be in the middle of Valdez Arm, right then. We don't have trees nearly that big in Prince William Sound. It had come in from southeast or something. The thing was 6 feet in diameter, hanging vertically in the water, going up and down like this. You know, the thing that'll take a boat out completely if it hits it, you know. And giant snag, and we all knew about it right away and everything, but the Coast Guard couldn't believe that we could be trusted to stay away from that snag. You know, they just know somebody was, you know, they were treating us. Coast Guard doesn't differentiate between commercial guys and pleasure guys, you know. And you know, we never, that thing was not a danger, but the Coast Guard was just preoccupied with it. And so the end of that first night, the Coast Guard had convinced us that they'd flown in all the helicopters, the thing that we had not anticipated and was scary, was that they brought all of the rescue helicopters from all over Alaska into harass us. Basically, they were flying, four or five of them, flying around the top of us, 100 boats, trying to knock our antennas off the boats with the helicopters, what it looked like. You know, when they were photographing us out the windows with cameras and all that, getting everybody's number and name and everything like that. And we had responded by laying out all the survival suits on the back deck of the boats and prepared to, you know,
go into the water
at moment's notice, boys. We ain't moving it. And the code, we'd been negotiating with them all day, of course, on this deal, you know, and they were threatening. And finally, they gave us the big word that afternoon, you know, that you will leave this waterway immediately or suffer the consequences, which at a minimum would be $44,000 fine per boat. And at the maximum, you may lose your boat entirely, loss of life as well, with all this shit, you know. And Jim Gray, the the spokesman for the group. He was famously not the leader. He was just the spokesman. He was radio contact on the Bly Reef. His boat. It was a Bly Reef. He was one of the spillionaires, and you typically name your boat after how you got the money to build it, right? So he named his boat the Bly Reef. And so he's talking to them, but he's a great real estate guy. I mean, this is a big real estate deal, and he could close it if anybody could. You know, there's always a lot of complications in real estate deals. He says, I got a lot of training here. I'll get this thing closed. And so he was negotiating away with them, and finally he says, well, I can't speak for anybody. I'm not the leader. You'll have to talk to every one of them on their own. And he recommended that we remove ourselves from the waterway. And 100 guys, so he wouldn't go to jail. You know, he was going to do the right thing, but he couldn't talk for anybody else. And then there's this wonderful tape that the Coast Guard must have in its archives, where 100 boats come back and say, we ain't moving. You know, when happened, as soon as it caught on, all the kids got handed the mics. It was all these 10-year-old kids saying it back to the Coast Guard. We're not moving. My dad says we're sticking and staying. You know? On and on, one boat after 100 boats went on for half an hour, you know. And the Coast Guard must have had tears in their eyes. It was the greatest. If I just had the foresight to have a tape recorder on. But I told one of the best captain of the port we had that I'd give anything for a copy of that tape, and he said he'd look into it, but he never got back to me. But I know it exists. But anyway, so after that episode, there was a long silence for a while, and the Coast Guard had a big cutter out there with us, but it was the Cordova boat. It wasn't a cutter; it was a buoy tender, you know, 100-foot buoy tender. But and it had a brand new captain aboard. He'd only been in town for like a month. They signed him for 3-year tours of duty on these buoy tenders. And he's the local Coast Guard presence in Cordova. And he was a great guy. He comes on the radio and he says, you know, we've been talking to him. And he says, I just moved my whole family to Cordova. He says, I got my kids in school. We're going to the Baptist church. He says, and I'm stuck there for the next 3 years, boys. I really don't want to have to break out this howitzer. He says, I hope to God we can avoid shooting at each other, because this is going to be, my family is not going to be happy about the situation. He was a great guy. He was a very sympathetic character, you know. And so the Coast Guard finally gets back on the radio late that afternoon. The choppers have been all over us, you know. And you come back on and say, okay, we're really concerned about that snag and about just the danger that you're poisoning everything. So we'll cut you a deal. If you guys will agree to move out of the waterway over to Jack Bay for the night and anchor up there, that we'll give you 2 hours of warning before any incoming tanker traffic comes in. Plenty of time for you to reorganize out there. We're not asking you to stop doing this now. You know, that's been settled. You guys are felons. You know, but can we all just as mariners agree to take it easy tonight? You know, go over to the harbor and we promise we'll call you. You know, and everybody going, God, what are we doing? And I got on the radio and said, take them at the word. I said, nobody's coming in here. I said, can you imagine an oil company stupid enough to send a tanker in against us on the same frame of a video camera? You know. You know, there's no way they're going to do this. You know, the smart move is them just to hang out there in the Gulf of Alaska and let this thing play itself out. Can any of us think it's going to go on for much longer? No. You know, I mean, we're just making a point here, and they're not going to come in. There's going to be no tanker coming in. Nobody's going to get run over or anything. It's just go to bed, you know, do what they say. We're already, you know, pissed them off about as much as we don't want another Waco here.
Yeah.
And so, and that prevailed, you know. So off we all went over and anchored up, and it's a nice aside. You're turning your tape into the Coast Guard, and since I was the only guy that knew where the commandant's office, where the captain of port's office was, I led the delegation in there, even though he and I were not getting along at the time. But and I was all bandaged up and everything. But I introduced him to Jim Gray and the rest of them. And Gray made his pitch about how it's a real estate deal here. We're all Republicans. We want to cut a deal. We think there's a deal available. It's just from getting everything together here. And believe me, there's no need for gunplay. The human safety has got to be the number one factor from our point of view, you know. And the captain reports saying, I really appreciate that. I know that about you guys. I mean, believe me, we're not going to call the ATF or anybody, you know. And it's, you know, the ATF is what did Waco.
And
he said, we're not calling the ATF or anything. Don't worry about it. We just want to make sure everybody, you know, settles down here and we get this waterway open as soon as possible, you know. And he says, all except this... James Michael. And Gray says, he's under sedation.
That's funny.
He's under sedation.
I'm going to have to look him up when I get to Cordova.
Oh, yeah, he's a great character.
See, I can see where...
The next day we managed, we continued the blockade. That was that night, and then so we pulled off and anchored up in Jack Bay. Well, of course, the Coast Guard, I think, were thinking the same thing that I was thinking, was that it would take a real fool to send a tanker in under these situations. You know, it's much easier. This is a short-lived situation. I'm sure the Coast Guard was telling the oil companies, you don't need to bring something in, just relax, you know, and so let's not have this confrontation. You know, we'll talk them out of it another day or so, you know. And that's what I thought, too. And I'm sure that's what the Coast Guard thought and everybody else thought. But British Petroleum decided to they had been pissed from the first time we met them on this blockade thing. They kept saying, it's not us, it's Exxon. We're not Exxon, we're British Petroleum. They're our enemies, too. You know, and we kept saying, you gave them gas during the spill. You guys are all peas in a pod. Blah, blah, blah. And so British Petroleum decided to show us that they were not. And they brought a tanker in at dawn the next morning, flanked with two Coast Guard cutters in front of it, roaring up the channel at 15 knots. And we would have been caught napping. It was like 5:30 in the morning, you know. And one young crew had stayed up all night and went roaring around just like Paul Revere, waking the whole 100-boat fleet up at 5 o'clock in the morning, throwing things and banging them, you know, and get out there, they're coming, get out there. And so we all jump up out of bed and roar out there in the middle of the bay, you know, and formed up our line, you know. And they came roaring right up to the last possible. It looked like they were really going to go through. And so I was telling people, okay, get ready to put your survival suits on. The next move is for 1,000 people to hop in the water. Let them come through that. You know, let's see them running over people in the water with these three big warships. You know, but at the last minute, as guys were starting to put their survival suits on, they turned around. You know, So it turned to Big Brody, and we got it on film, and this tanker just doing this great 360 at 180 and heading back out, you know, at the last possible minute. The Coast Guard never did call it off. They were being flanked and escorted in by the two, and they would have run right through us. You know, according to I have a good friend in British Petroleum, and he said, and he was the guy calling the shots for British Petroleum. He was the head guy on scene. And he was up in a chopper, and he was just screaming, you know, British obscenities at the top of his voice, kill, because we were on his channel, you know. We were talking to him on his own private channel. We know the radio deal, you know, so we can get on anybody's radio channel, and we were on all their channels all the time, and they let them know that we were on all their channels, you know. So he knew we were listening, and he was putting on this great show, kill the babies. Kill the women, kill everybody, you know, just a mile a minute from his chopper up there. And I caught him when we went in to meet Babbitt. So anyway, they turned it around at the last minute, you know, and we didn't know who turned it around. So we went in to meet with Babbitt that afternoon. He'd gotten down to Valdez, and we were still maintaining the blockade, right? We turned him around by this time, and Babbitt shows up. And as we're walking up to the meeting, he comes down, grabs me, he says, I don't want you to know, Tom, I wasn't really trying to kill you. I said, sure, sounded like it. And he says, no, man, I was trying to get the Coast Guard to turn us around. He said, I'm just a lonely employee here. I can't be turning tankers around. He said, I had to maintain my thing. I said, I was just trying to be as belligerent as possible so the Coast Guard would, you know, take command and say, okay, that's enough. Hold it. You know, turn this baby around, you know. And I mean, I said, our tanker was following orders from the cutters, of course, you know. But he said they never did. He said, I finally had to just do it. He said, it was getting to the point where we couldn't turn the tanker around anymore, you know. And so I finally had to bite the bullet and turn my tanker around. He said, the Coast Guard would run right over you guys. So he got it to us anyway. So we all retired into Valdez. After, I mean, the buoy stayed out, but the leadership went into Valdez to meet with Babbitt. And so he says, he starts the meeting by saying, so I hear we're talking about an exit strategy here, right? And Jim goes, oh, absolutely. That's the whole idea. That exit, nobody gets hurt. We all walk away from this. Blah, blah, blah. You know. And so he says, well, what's it all about? And so it fell to me to present the argument to him, which was that do we have to settle dime on the dollar with Exxon in the civil damages suit before you guys will start to look at what's wrong with the salmon and herring stocks in Prince William Sound? It appears to be what the situation is. Why haven't you spent a single dime on salmon and herring in the past 5 years, 4 years? And I said, it looks to us like a deal you secretly made with Exxon so not to develop any evidence for us to use in our trial. Well, how about we just agree not to use the evidence in our trial, and you guys try to starve me? Now, here we are starving to death. No salmon, no herring, no investigation of what's wrong with them. You know, just nothing out of you guys. No response to the major commercial species in Prince William Sound to date. And no explanation that holds water, you know. And Babbitt says, and he turns to his chief aide and says, you hear anything about this? And the guy says, I'll know tonight, he says. And Babbitt says, well, if there's anything to this, we can fix that. I said, and you control the three. I said, this whole, from our point of view, this whole thing was to get you come to this meeting so we could talk to you, because you appoint the three federal trustees. And we want to know, what about our salmon and herring? Very simple question. What about our salmon and herring? What have you done in 4 years? Or salmon and herring, why haven't you done anything? And he said, oh, no problem on that. Shake hands, get the hell home, you know. And he promised to, you know, speed along the Exxon money too, but nobody, that was not a serious thing in the inner circles. You know, we knew he had no ability to make Exxon pay up ahead of time. Right. But anyway, the upshot was, within a week, they had set up the SEAS program at the Trustees Council, $20 million allocated for salmon and herring research in Prince William Sound. And it's been one of the most spectacularly successful programs that the Trustees Council ran. It's been going on forever, and it's generated tremendous data about both salmon and herring. And they put out a fancy supplement to a scientific journal about 2 or 3 years ago that I briefly saw and have not been able to secure another copy of, that big fancy four-color supplement to this journal about the SEAS program. And the first paragraph says, we got the money because the fishermen blockaded Valdez Arm.
Well, so do you recall the name of the journal? I mean, they may have that file someplace at RCS.
I've looked.
Oh, you have?
I've gotten some leads on it, but I haven't been able to get it back in my hand. And the best lead was from there's a database for all of the trustee council stuff in Anchorage. And they didn't have a copy, but they knew what I was talking about. You know, the librarian that runs that archive for the trustee council, and she directed me in the right way, and I tried to find it at the UW library, mm-hmm, and stuff.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to come up with it. It's not available online.
Yeah.
But anyway, so there's that. It's just an interesting offsite. But it was beautiful because it's so dramatically in the first paragraph stated very clearly that this is a direct result of the fisherman 1993 blockade of Valdez Narrows, and we got our $20 million, and here's what we've done over the past 10 years with it, you know.
Okay, you know.
So it was a very highly successful civil disobedience, and vanishingly rare in this country.
It seems to me that the three stories that you, the theme of this interview has been three stories that are the same theme, that you're talking about the power of the individual when they really decide to take charge. You're talking about your bucket brigade, you're talking about the blockade in 93, And you're also talking about RCAC,
the most the thing you left out there was not just me, but well, in 1990, I bet there were 100 commercial fishermen from Prince William Sound in South Central Alaska that went back to D.C. during the actual passage of Open 90 and lobbied all of those people hard. My Floyd Hutchins, the guy who was the communications guy I told you about earlier, he and I did 135 office buildings in 3 days, 135 congressional staffs, and 135. Alyeska flew the vice president out to get us drunk in Tip O'Neill's bar at the end of the second night to try to stop us from the third day, but...
That's just the way you get Alaska's cranked up.
But no, we hit every swing guy on the vote for Open 90. And Floyd would get me in the door. He's a real charmer, and I'd be the pitch man, you know, once we got in there. And about 5 minutes in office, man, in and out, you know. And we were only one of several delegations that were making that same route, you know, all coordinated by this lawyer for works for off and on for the state back there. But it never really had us. It wasn't like one group doing it. It was like 10 groups. You know, our CDFU was there, City of Valdez, City of Cordova. There was a lot of players doing this. This was before RCAC got started. See, RCAC started as a result. It started actually, to be precise, concurrently with that effort. Alyeska saw the writing on the walls and set up a voluntary group that they thought they could control a little better than what was being written in the federal legislation. And so the RCAC that became extant was the voluntary alternative to the federally mandated one. It's a little different than what's called for in federal legislation. Uh-huh. And most of us think it's stronger than the one that we'd have gotten from the federal legislation, as it turned out.
Yeah.
And a better design than what showed up. In the final analysis of the federal law. And that's the difference between Cook Inlet and us. Cook Inlet is the federal version. And Prince William Sound is the private enterprise response to the imminent threat of the federal version. Mm-hmm. And so there's an interesting thing there, too, that could bear some looking into. But that's the thing that the lasting lesson for me of this whole thing was the power of the individual to change things. It's not that you're powerless in an overwhelming, you know, capitalist system that you can't respond to. No, I was very responsive to us. After a while, it was a lag time, that awful 2 weeks. Yeah. Yeah, but after that, from that point on, we've been very successful in getting our will, having our say, you know, and getting it done. And it's night and day. Night and day, and, you know, it was very amazing going back to D.C. and helping to see a bill written. You know, one of the stories I like to tell is how we got double hulls. There was a British equivalent of 60 Minutes muckraking journalism, over there called the Eye or something like the Scottish Eye. I think it was a Scottish Eye, and that's supposed to be quizzical and money counted, you know, perspicuous, and. Parsimonious, and but anyway, their story was in the wake of the Exxon Valdez was no need to worry. The new oil terminal in the Shetland Islands has been built. Much stricter environmental requirements than what we get away with in the former colonies. You know, we could build a shipshod ship because British Petroleum has 50% of the pipeline. You know, they're the big boys up there. Exxon only has 25%. So it's always been a British Petroleum pursuit, and so their point was, well, we built this sister refinery in Alaska. It's true, but it doesn't have nearly the environmental controls that we enjoy in the Shetland Islands, our home territory. You know, and it was about a 20-minute tape that was just calculated to raise the ire of a U.S. congressman. You know, and George Miller had got a copy of it, the great representative from Long Beach, California. My favorite guy, if I had to pick somebody for president, it would be George Miller. Wonderful, wonderful congressman. And he's been doing it for 20, 30 years now. But he was the guy who got Open 90 passed. And he was our mainstay. And he'd slipped us a copy of this tape. It was, of course, no copyrights, right? It was totally illegal. You know, yeah. So, one of my tasks was to go get 50 copies of this printed up and distribute it around to the remaining swing voters at the time it was being passed. And, And so I had shown up in Capitol Hill that morning. It was the morning of the debate on double halls. And I'd shown up. I'd distributed maybe half of those copies the night before, and then I had the other half in a backpack, you know, and walking around getting ready to pass them out. And you could hear the screams coming out of George Miller's office for the entire north wing of the congressional offices. The president of British Petroleum America was in his office, and they were, you know, people said it was the most loud and obnoxious screaming that they'd heard in the month of Sundays. I mean, those two were at each other, top voice, man, just screaming on the notion of this tape that had been circulated, you know, that the British Petroleum was pissed that we had this unauthorized British tape that was being distributed around, very presidential to the debate on double hulls, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And just as that was going on, word reached us that a single hull tanker had sat down on its own anchor at low tide in Long Beach, George Miller's district. It had anchored up out in front waiting to go in and had miscalculated where it was and sat down on its own anchor and driven, punctured a hole in its single hull and was pouring oil out of George Miller's home district. And every British Petroleum lobbyist and all the oil lobbyists just walked out of the building, said, okay, it's over with. We're gone. You know, let's go have lunch, boys. And we got the double hull thing passed. It was not an easy thing. We may not have ever gotten it if it hadn't been for that lucky oil spill on George Miller's home turf.
Yeah.
Day, yeah. But it was over with. It was this. There's been a number of things along the way where it was just like, you know, if you were a Christian, you could say God's hand was in this. You know, it was just like things like that.
Yeah.
Just, you know, just.
Well, when you. So now, an article for us to access here is ADN, October 1, 1989, and we have Tom on record, and his quote is, "You reach a point when you realize that you're not living in civilization, you're living in barbaric times. You think there are these people in government who are trying to protect your interests, then you find out that that isn't so. A lot of people in Cordova found that out this summer. No, the system doesn't work. Look at the state of Alaska. It's addicted to oil money. You talk about kids getting off drug abuse. Alaska is addicted to oil money. How about your permanent fund? The Alaska state government has got to pull the 6-foot needle out of its arm. No, the system doesn't work. The state of Alaska was to blame. It was their goddamn fault. Of course the oil companies weren't going to be ready for the problem. They're only going to do what you make them." End quote.